R22, tout le monde. Antenne, tout le monde.
Once again, the conversations are working so well, just in the panel, across panels, that those of us who have been here for 2.5 days, I think really are beginning to appreciate. So thank you to Shela and to Jennifer in particular, and to everyone who's been participating, and to, of course, once again, Marco and Aileen for shaping us into something that drifts in a productive way, I think. I've reached that age when you can say, the good thing about getting old is... The good thing about being old is you don't remember what you just said. Now I haven't reached quite that part. I wish I did. You know, some of us remember, I'm sure, a conversation that enveloped the creme de la creme of the critical theorists in the 80s and the 90s, and it went under the rubric of the particular and the universal, the singular and the general, and then it in some ways mutated into the local and global. And there was just volume after volume of who's who of thinkers who were struggling. How do we think the singular and the, I can't remember how it all went together, but you know, that this and this. And what, in some ways, what we knew then and we can certainly see now is what was pushing it was indeed the effects of both radical and liberalizing multiculturalism and recognition, and the pressure even liberal recognition was putting on these universal, this notion of the universal, and how certain regions of critical theory was still, you know, feeding on that. And I bring this up because I think that's not what you two are doing when you're thinking about how to re-engage the planetary, there are three terms sitting around. There's the global, there's the planetary, and then there's the world and the planetary. So I don't know if you guys want to make an argument about which way to go. But I bring it up because I think it's important to register a difference that not merely in terminology, not merely in how we define these terms, but by a epistemic shift that has occurred between the 80s and the present. Again, I think an epistemic shift that might be enunciated in some of the academies of the West, the US and Europe and elsewhere, but have emerged from, again, a pressure out of these non-places. And I bang on about this. I don't know how do you translate bang on about this. I fear how you translate. I go on and on. I repeat myself. I repeat myself over and over. But I will do so again because it bears on what I think is at stake and what you're doing. And that we now, and I think we in the specificity of this room now live within certain kind of axioms that subtend what we're doing, that subtend the struggle that we're witnessing here to think about the planetary in the wake of toxicity, climate change, tipping points. And that's these four axioms, which are existence is entangled, right? Here-ish, now-ish, middle-ish, right? Not up, not down, right? Neither the ground nor the sky. But, and they usually start, and again, I'm just going to repeat myself, but it usually starts in the West. This is why you can see the refiguration that happens when it enters into the academy. It usually starts there as an ontological claim. Existence is entangled. And then as a subsidiary, it says, but that doesn't smooth the world because it's entangled in such a way that various, what we might consider locals or what you might consider, not worlds and you, planetary?
Worlds too, so.
Okay, worlds are good. Okay, so the worlds, right, different worlds in this complex entanglement have differential abilities to affect entanglement because what we misunderstand as scale is instead the density of that entanglement, which is intended to circulate, to form what can move, and that's what we were talking about just recently, to form what can move, to say this kind of thing can move and that kind of thing can only drift or it can be stuck, depending on gender, depending on, right? And to try and flow values in one way and leave the refuse of that formation of value elsewhere. So indeed, it's not scale. It's the density of that entanglement. But, and indeed, for me, the first axiom that existence is entangled only matters because of that second one. It, who cares what it in what being is? I couldn't give a damn what being is. I care about how worlds are entangled in such a way that this differential effects accumulate and are distributed. The third, I think Jennifer really was coming up when you're talking about eventfulness, and this definitely stretches back to Deleuze and others, but there's a multiplicity now of event forms that we really pay attention to, the catastrophe, but also the quasi-event, the small event, the events that characterize the places of the swamp dwellers, to cite a novel, mm-hmm. in which intensities never even reach an event, but just pull, right? Just pull, just make the getting up every day, right? But again, that matters because of this uneven distribution and blah, blah, blah. And finally, the provincialization of Western epistemology. That's what we all sit in right now. I think that in some ways that sits as what we take as for granted in the background. Some begin with ontology, which I think is wrong. You have to begin with provincialization and move backwards so that you realize when we say existence is entangled, it's not an ontological claim, it's a political claim. Yeah. And then the question is, if that's what the politics of, if that's the existence in which we're trying to figure a politics, indeed, what would the political be here? And that's, and I don't know either. But it cannot be a politics that thinks either in terms of the individual or even, and that's why one of the questions is, I'm not quite getting a world, the world, because I thought, because I'm kind of here-ish now, so it can't be this and it can't be that, right? So what I love about what you, and it can't be pluralizing either, because pluralizing means we can just add more singularities. When in fact, if you think about this entanglement, and that's it's entangled in order to do something, that is to extract in order to enhance, not in general, but as we were speaking, in specific. Yeah. So if we're going if we're successful in you know, turning the forces, using the seepages or the Olivia, when the things that permeating through, able to do that such that we change the direction or change that the way we're knotted, of course we're going to change everything. We re-knot the world. And that means some of these knots, whoof, go. Francoise went to, is speaking of the men with the Rolex watches. Yes, they go. Right? We don't pluralize by just getting, well, everyone has their little piece of the pie. No, they go. They're right. Goodbye. Right? And not just die, like existence. Poof. Gone. So I say that just to emphasize or underline why I think, well, I just want to make sure you're heard not to be doing what was happening and then the complexity of a politics that can no longer work with this liberal model of the individual or the universal. And what we see, and this is where I end and then like hand it back and really think about this incommensurability of decolonizing, is one of the things we see, and I'm hoping you guys can talk more about it, in I've seen some of the critical left, I don't know what to call it, climate thing, is a new kind of Stalinism, and in which it's like all you people who have your particularities and have been saying, well, you know, me as a, this is a global matter, we can only solve it globally, and so we have to abstract up into what we all share, or we're not going to solve the problem, right? So it's not as if that abstraction ceases to have power. It's I think, coming back. So within that big kind of conversation, there were a couple of things. One, indeed, was for me that, like, is that true? I see it, this kind of new Stalinism of anti-particularity, but just returning to a kind of universalism. And the second, could you tell us more about those pictures that you were showing us? I was like, they're really cool, but you didn't describe any of them, did you? Or did I, like, nap off? So I want to know more about the projects themselves, right? What? So there was one which you had some junk on a tree and stuff. There was a birdhouse, mm-hmm. But you never said what it was. So I'm interested because you're trying to get there, but you didn't describe what they were. So I would actually just like to hear more about that. And then for me, other. Yeah. Why other?
A or the.
Yeah. As a way of, and then I thought maybe, you know, you guys, there's here, get rid of these, and then we're not gonna have a summary, so everybody jump into.
Right. Do you want to go first? Thank you for that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I didn't want to reiterate those questions, those debates of the 80s, but I'm thinking it from this particular moment in the context of this kind of managed global environmentalism, which we know through your work goes hand in hand through the management of subjectivities and the creation of certain subjects, and then the sort of pedagogical processes that are part and parcel of that, and what your work and what your filmmaking does and doesn't teach or gets us to think about. I think there's something particular that's happening at the moment so we need to somehow change the register of that very old conversation. And also my question is, okay, how do you bring a bunch of students into these debates, which have been happening from the 80s onwards, as you say, without boring the hell out of them by running through all of these really well-worn discourses, and how do you sort of invigorate that for them in the present moment? And also how do you teach them to know not to know, basically, between the specific and the universalizable. And I think that's something that there was a beautiful conversation about that yesterday, in terms of sort of errancy and learning and sort of creating an infrastructure that really isn't a proper infrastructure, in which one can be experience visitation, experience the unexpected, experience the event. It's the same thing in the classroom, I think. But it's very hard to teach students that without it becoming programmatic and without it becoming dictatorial in some way. The A and the thee is, yeah, that's the problem. That's the question. It depends from where you're standing, right? Like, and that's why I was mentioning the idea of the death of the other or the end of the world. If if I lose someone, it's the end of the world for me, right? Whereas for anyone else, it's the end of a world. So it was precisely that slippage as to how that's dealt with.
What I find, and again, young people in the audience, not to make you young or anything, but one of the, not to make me old, actually. One of the things that is great about this moment is that I do think this, the at least in some spaces, this, as much as a kind of hardening of identities in order to make an infrastructure of power visible. So the point about identity was to make visible something you couldn't see, not to actually believe that identities were hard, right? It was to say how they're formed and to force those who got to live in the world as if there was nothing there. They were moving, they weren't being moved, right? Which we have to, I have to support, that's right. But one of in this moment, I think that in the classroom, which you can kind of assume people know that their existence is an effect of a, you know, loosely speaking, a network, a mode of circulation that is entangled and entangled in ways that they don't know the end of. Like if you watch your string go out, you don't know where it's quite going and the conditions of making it. And I think that's what Olivia, in terms of the errantness and the, and Louis, the spiraliness is, and the circulation we're talking about this morning, is investigatory and constitutive, right? So I think it's a good moment in the classroom in which it's like you can't go back into your self as a self, and you can't universalize yourself anymore, because we know you can't do that. So what kind of political affects and gestures and subjects don't make us all the same, but don't essentialize that? Yeah. So it's a,
that's where the slip between the world and the A world. I mean, I hadn't really prioritized that before, but since you ask it as a question, I guess maybe that's one way of responding, that you can only get students to go and experience that, exactly what you've just said, by trying to do something. Like, you can't, it doesn't end in the classroom, right? It doesn't begin or end in the classroom, we all know that. And it's only through them undergoing that, through the process of the world, like my world, that they can understand, they can begin to understand exactly what you're saying.
Thanks also for that amazing set of four axioms and provocation from things that came out of our talk. I think this question of the particular and the universal is a really important one to return to, because it sort of like we still have a hangover from this moment, and the number of people who I hear trying to basically kind of work through this space through appealing to scale as a way of, merely kind of updating or remedying the problems of the particular and the universal, the local and the global. It's still such a kind of prevailing discourse, even though scale itself has been critiqued ad nauseum as something that assumes kind of singular ontology or world, again, requires kind of relatively seamless set of translations, that translation is always possible within a kind of scalar logic. So it doesn't depart from that assumption. So I think more work potentially needs to be done to try to revisit and force these sorts of logics to show how they don't work. I mean, the number of kind of environmental projects that I hear really kind of referring to the local and the global and seeing the local as the solution, which is why I appreciate your work to also try to disrupt that, as though we need to kind of just return to ecotopic communities. And I think this gets to your question then about a new kind of critical left Stalinism. I don't think it necessarily only comes from the left. Interestingly, there's quite a lot of work on the environment on the right and across the spectrum, even if you kind of work with the left-right, a way of understanding politics. But there certainly are new practices, epistemes, and languages of control. And then I think this gets to your point about the event that mobilize a certain idea of catastrophe. They mobilize a certain kind of end of the world in order to legitimate a certain kind of new Stalinism, as you've put it, or a particular way of assembling a we that flattens certain kinds of difference and makes solutions apparent, like the basin of attraction that I showed. Because actually that article, which is seemingly a kind of science article, is primarily an article about social codes, planetary governance, and so on, about how we would live in the world, assuming a universal we, assuming universal worlds, and an obvious problem to be acted upon. And it often is people coming from environmental sciences with the best of intentions who are trying to solve these problems because the time is now, in a kind of heroic, even masculinist fashion, of trying to make the world a stable place for us to continue to flourish in human civilization. So there's so much that's assumed and unquestioned there, and a certain kind of hardening then of what it would mean to live in those socio-political spaces and the kinds of violence that would happen in order to enforce that way of understanding the catastrophe. And there's been a lot of work done, for instance, in critical indigenous theory, also in critical race theory. And I was sort of speaking about this actually at the Hakave where Louis was last week, but about the end of this world. For instance, Kyle Powis White, Anishinaabe scholar, has said, well, the end has kind of already happened. If you are indigenous.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, I missed yesterday. I was away. But so for 50 million people at a certain point in time, the end has come and gone. And for other scholars, that ending is narrated in a particular way as an end of a world that privileges certain kinds of people, and so on. So also the politics of the event, the politics of what events are marshaled in order to suggest that this is the kind of political problem that we all need to organize in relation to and act on in this way, it assumes so much. When so many other events that we've inherited are also part of these kinds of registers. So, thinking about those things, not only as pluralisms, as you've suggested, because that can be just adding an S onto everything, but is actually kind of transforming the registers in which we're understanding problems, for instance, and ways of inhabiting.
Can we, because I also want you to look, but can we just pause on the question of ends and loss? Because I think one of the things that I don't hear much in the science, there's a lot of talk about grand tipping scales and finalities, like loss as finality, right? And boom, it's over. For all of us. That we all hear, for all of us, and that for all of us is supposed to do this weight. But what we don't hear so much about is, and you were saying, it's events don't happen at a global scale, even when they happen at a global scale. So there could be a global scale something, and it's not going to, everything everywhere is not going to be exactly the same, right? It's going to be a little hotter here and uninhabitable than there, little hotter and uninhabitable. So it's like clouds. They don't form the exact same way everywhere. But it's not simply also that when we, let's say we could wave our wand and somehow come up with the force and to reorganize this entanglement, it's not as if then we would remain the same in the entanglement. So it's all of us working to reorganize this would also be reorganized, right? So there's there, in that sense, you could say there's all political action is inherently about the loss of the self, right? You want to lose who you are because who you are is an effect of this here-ish, there-ishness. And I don't think we talk about that as much. I don't think the global climate change people talk about it other than on the catastrophic scale, but that what we're also asking is everybody, we're working toward our own specific extinctions in order to change. And I don't mean extinction as now we're on a hot planet, but we're a different subject. We don't get to remain ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's what I was trying to kind of signal toward by working with Winter Spivak, coming up with the idea of being planetary as praxis. We don't get to be the same subjects. These new configurations of the planetary force us to be new subjects. And I suppose lurking in the background in that thinking is kind of older reading that I've been doing with Whitehead and thinking about how we are always subjects, superjects. So we're never just subjects cognizing the world as a brain in a vat, as it were, but environments are always running through us, changing us, and this very much resonates with Indigenous thought and practice as well. So to take that seriously is to really think about becoming different kinds of subjects as kind of generative project of also bringing different planets and different environments and different worlds into being, and that's also a kind of project with collective potential, since we can't also assume what kinds of collectives might be politically possible in order to address those kinds of changes.
Could you talk about the specific projects you showed us?
The junk on the trees.
The junk on the trees, yeah.
There's more than junk on the trees, but so this is a longer-term project I've been working on sensors, environmental sensors, and the junk on the trees were sensors from a sensor testbed in California. And that was set up, that was a National Science Foundation project. I didn't work on that, but I visited it as a kind of field work in the mid-2000s. And it is a project that was deploying these new environmental sensors to try to understand ecosystems. And it suggested that different kinds of ecological relations would come into view through having masses of data and through observing forests, in this case, because it was mostly a forest ecosystem, through kind of 24/7 collection of data. So I didn't talk about that because I didn't want to kind of get into the detail of that, but to have it as more of a figure for thinking about how forests potentially come into view politically, technologically, through the different kinds of subjects who are investigating, observing, witnessing, working with those environments. So that was kind of threaded through in a slightly more abstract way, where the argument was a bit more concrete. But this is something that I've been thinking about quite closely in relation to how environmental problems are configured, often through these kinds of devices, these ways of observing and configuring environments. And perhaps this gets to some of your work that Shella brought up on the telescope, and it was the binoculars, and how shifting the gaze and shifting the kinds of modes of engagement can also be ways of shifting the kind of political and other registers. Don't know if you want to bring that in there.
Can I just ask you, picking up on, because, okay, I'm Beth knows, she's heard me talk about this. I'm interested in the problematics of representation and coming back to your question about the sort of undoing of the subject, you know, this now we know in the sort of academic climate we're in, but also in many day-to-day experiences that, you know, we also following on from your work, we emerge as subjects in relation to our environments, in relation to non-human entities, so on and so forth, non-living entities, and all that. So that really radically changes the question of representation and agency. And again, this is something you address in your book in terms of the sort of voiceless demos as well. But then, Jennifer, I'd forgotten that you talk about the forest in terms of, and planetarity in terms of a resistance to representation. And then you were talking about the gaze from within planetarity, or the within planetary inhabitation, and then showing all these images with the different standpoint, the different gaze, the different focal point. And then you're talking about within asymmetrical but non-subjugating relations and the images themselves being suggestive of modes of planetary praxis. Can you just say more in terms of how that gets around old problems of representation and how the images themselves are operative? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question. And I don't know that the images necessarily do get around that problem as we look at them in this room, potentially. But I think there are different ways of mobilizing images as data, as kind of political forms. So it's, as Haroon Farooqi would say, an operational engagement with images, which can be used for surveillance and for war machines and all the rest of it. But also there could be ways of operationalizing new cosmologies with and through images that don't fit within the kind of registers that we're accustomed to in terms of how we engage with images. So that might also be about reworking the kind of image encounters, the way that those are configured, not as flat planes of kind of enlightenment packages of information, but rather as things that, like land, like environments, run through us that we carry with us, more like sound even, if we think about how to destabilize the image from its kind of priority and what the kind of image does as a kind of dominant form, how to potentially rework the image as something that is carried and operates in a different way. But
we were talking about meringues, maroons. Maroons made out of pollution. Meringues. I know. That's
Lemon meringue.
Well, it was pollution meringues. Yeah. So as an art project.
Oh yeah, that's been done with smog. Actually, yeah, I know those people.
Where's our? Oh, there you are. Yay.
Genomic gastronomy.
Yeah. So we began yesterday really trying to think about forms of artistic practice in relation to the global distribution of toxicity. And I'm going to mangle it because at this point my mind is a meringue. but starting with these Cabinet of Wonders, which had a certain kind of order and a kind of preciousness, to, I forget who made the meringues. Yeah, Jenna.
Yes, Kat Kramer and Zach Denfield.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And there, we'll pass the microphone to you if you would take it, please. No. I mean, there was a really interesting question because it was not representation, right? It was this.
Right.
It was an artistic practice trying to think through toxicity. So I was hoping that you would jump in, but you didn't, so I had to pull you in like a hook in a bait.
Here we go. Yeah, it was a question about ingesting toxic mm-hmm. products. In fact, a nuclear sup or these smog meringues, and try to change your perspective, not only looking at, observing the toxicity, the globality, but try to ingest it, mm-hmm. to incorporate really as a corp, mm-hmm. not an entire body, already a little bit dead, mm-hmm. a corpse, really. And try to change the mode, because the mode of representation of global environmental problems at a global scale is quite impossible, and it didn't work since the 60s. Mm-hmm. So let's try to focus somewhere else. Maybe inside the body, as a global system also, as a kind of plan itself. And that's what I tried to do mm-hmm. yesterday. I'm starting from the Wunderkammer, the Cabinet of Curiosity, with the environmental photography as a testimony of attempt in the 60s and 70s to try to aware about all these issues, and then try to find other forms different from the documentary film forms that were your specialty, Elizabeth and Olivier also, and try to see if a spectator as a citizen could be a performer. So it was the point.
Just to add, and you can edit me if I'm wrong, but also what was for me quite powerful, at least about the Meringue Project and others like it. There are others like it, like the in the Times Museum, the woman who collected the water and let it saturate down. Amazing, powerful. Mm. Was that it did two things at the same time. It showed this is your phrase, the normal, I would have to look, but the normality of toxicity. But the uneven distribution. So the different intensifications, which really matter with toxicity, because it's all about, you know, it's how much can you process out, right? So that it got, the artistic research was a way of errantly moving in order to show this distribution and intensification, right? So outside of representation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would say I've done a fair amount of work on sensing and sensing practices that definitely tries to work outside of those usual logics of representation. And one way in which I've done that is through a collaborative project called Citizen Sense, where we're working with sensors to monitor environments and try to mobilize understandings of pollution, air pollution in particular, which is kind of how I know about this project. And Kat's also done some teaching for me. So, thinking about how we are incorporating environments, how that is changing our kinds of bodily inhabitations and encounters, and how we might not even process the pollutants out, how we might actually become different kinds of entities with different sensibilities, different ways of being in the world, really. But one of the terms that I've used in relation to some of the thinking about experience and data is also, again, from, well, a kind of riff on Whitehead. I developed this notion of creaturing, to think not about representing, but about the new entities that are made and formed. And those are ways of experiencing and sensing. Those are ways of kind of potentially understanding the world in the way that representations might have at one time operated. And they also form in very particular ways as environments of relevance. So different kinds of things are joined up as a result of these creatures, which are also processual. So perhaps that's my attempt to kind of intervene in that space of representation. But Shella, you've done so much also thinking about the politics of representation in relation to post-coloniality. So you might have more to say about that.
No, I mean, I've drawn on your work as well in terms of, even though it's based in the sort of so-called West, it's still, in a sense, it's enacting in a really interesting way the work of Viveiros de Castro and Amerindian thinking in terms of perspectivism. And I think this goes back to like the discussion from this morning as well around the flaneur and the gaze and the position. And I'm thinking of someone like Lugones's work of streetwalking and sort of potential other ways of positioning oneself sort of in the midst of things that allow other things, other creatures, other subjects, if we're going to use that word, to have a perspective and to have a point of view. I think your work, it speaks for itself in terms of an alternative to modes of representation that could become quite sort of violent in terms of the old questions around the subaltern and not being receptive and not hearing, right, not giving, and sort of in an attempt to advocate for ending up silencing and reproducing that which they're seeking to sort of get around, let's say.
Yeah, we open up to questions, comments.
Just to say that the science fiction does that, Est-ce que je peux parler en français peut-être? Ok. Oui, d'accord. Non, c'est que la science-fiction d'ailleurs fait depuis très très longtemps. On a parlé hier de non-places, des zones. Je ne sais pas si vous avez lu de Philip K. Dick, The Penimultate, La vérité avant-dernière. Comment il y a des zones où les gens infectés par la radioactivité, ils sont délimités là, alors qu'il est vrai. D'ailleurs, c'est une métaphore avec le mythe de la caverne de Platon et comment ils n'ont pas accès au vrai monde qui est évidemment un monde blanc, élitiste, etc., alors qu'ils sont délimités dans le niveau de radioactivité. Mais encore, je crois qu'on est un peu, comment dire, délimité par les limites en fait ontologiques, parce qu'en fait c'est toujours la fiction spéculative qui n'est pas assez légitime, et j'ai recours au dilemme que Ursula Le Guin a posé entre en fait légitimité de la science-fiction et fiction spéculative. Et la science-fiction est capable d'imaginer ce qui peut vraiment arriver, même actuellement. Du coup, si ça peut vraiment arriver actuellement, pourquoi elle n'est pas légitime en tant que science? Bon, c'est juste... Pardon? Oui. En fait, la différence entre science-fiction comme genre et spéculation et fiction spéculative, c'est que la science-fiction peut vraiment les scénarios arriver même actuellement. Parce qu'ils se sont vraiment basés sur un raisonnement d'ailleurs très occidental, de typique argumentation aristotélicienne. Du coup, si vraiment basé sur des vrais faits scientifiques, du coup, pourquoi la science-fiction n'a pas de valeur des sciences, alors que la science occidentale fait exactement ça? Pose des arguments bien raisonnables pour arriver, pour dire des conclusions.
Je voulais juste peut-être rebondir sur ce que vous demandez pour peut-être... Non, c'est pour peut-être ajouter un soubassement. Ah, you don't have it. Sorry. This is the real science fiction, is that? Look at that. Non, c'est peut-être pour ajouter un... Dans votre question, donc une autre question, de quoi parle-t-on lorsqu'on parle de science-fiction? Parce que c'est là, en fait, que tout se joue. Vous passez d'Ursula Le Guin à Philip K. Dick. Déjà, moi, je trouve qu'il y a deux science-fictions extrêmement différentes. Celle qui est une forme, je dirais, pour reprendre les termes d'Isabel Stengers, une forme de science-fiction d'aggravation du présent, qui est plutôt masculine, qui est plutôt faite pour nous convaincre de l'espèce d'impossibilité de d'autres scénarios que des scénarios qui seraient des aggravations du présent. Et donc, ce n'est pas tellement de la science-fiction, en réalité, c'est simplement l'idée qu'on pourrait construire une histoire linéaire qui ne ferait que s'aggraver de manière linéaire, alors que je pense que dans la science-fiction féministe, il y a vraiment une prise vers d'autres possibilités qui ne sont pas toujours complètement inscrites dans le présent, qui gardent la saveur, hier on parlait de l'appât, qui gardent la saveur de quelque chose du présent, mais qui quand même changent un ou des paramètres. Chez Le Guin, c'est souvent le point de départ, il est toujours différent de ce qu'on vit. Qu'est-ce qui se passerait si, et ce qui se passerait si, change beaucoup de choses qu'une science-fiction qui dit... En fait, le futur, c'est le présent aggravé. Voilà. Et donc, cette espèce d'aggravation du présent, pour moi, c'est de la politique néolibérale, quoi. C'est-à-dire, c'est nous conduire de manière presque imaginaire, forcée, vers l'aggravation du présent, et l'accepter, finalement. Donc, ce qui nous est présenté comme le futur est déjà beaucoup le présent. Donc, c'est pas une vision, en réalité, mais c'est plutôt une aggravation du présent.
Désolée, c'est le sujet de ma thèse, du coup, c'est pour ça que c'est un peu... non, du coup, pour les seules choses où je ne suis pas tout à fait d'accord, c'est en fait parce que ce n'est pas exactement la science-fiction masculine, parce qu'en fait, ces débats sur le genre, c'était entre Ursula Le Guin, qui a nommé, c'est que je dis comme ça, la science-fiction, c'est qui peut vraiment arriver, et Margaret Atwood, qui parle d'une science-fiction qui encore va vers la métaphysique. Vous voyez ce que je veux dire. Du coup, ce n'est pas une question de faits plutôt scientifiques, légitimes et science-fiction masculine, mais plutôt une question ontologique, comment on peut voir le monde et imaginer le monde autrement. Bon, juste pour... Je n'étais pas claire, désolée.
Much depends on this. The if is speculative, or if the if is, in the world, but not actualized yet.
Yes.
Yeah. Or, but that's it is actualized. It's what about it can't densify or something. I don't know. I don't have words for it, but it's a seepage already there. Mm-hmm. It's a seepage that's in any system. Yeah, yeah. Or Deleuze's virtual actual. I'm trying not to do it because I'm trying to think if, I don't know, just because it's so influential to me. But the seepage, if we want to say the seepage out of the virtual, we could say, but there's also seepage in the actual. And the seepage is most of the it's all of those knots that are being used to redirect value, right? And they don't work quite. So I do think that it's important whether we look at science fiction as speculative or as something that not just if it were, but no, it is. Oh, it is. It's just. Oh, composé, it's not composing itself quite yet, or it's trying to, sorry. François?
Oui, il y a la question du genre, mais enfin, juste pour ajouter aussi à ce que disait Olivier, il y a la question aussi, par exemple, de toute la science-fiction écrite par Octavia Butler, qui est absolument autre chose aussi, qui est en dans un devenir catastrophique, mais où les femmes noires, finalement, c'est elles qui ramènent quelque chose de la solidarité de la vie. Bon, ça, c'était juste une remarque. Pour Jennifer, je voulais vous demander...
Could I just add, okay. and it is prior to, of course, I love Donna Haraway, but it is the condition of
Much
Donna's
before.
Work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's very important to read that, because it's, I mean, even when in one of her novels, where the fascist guy who come to power is an electoral campaign is made on Make America Great Again. Remember? It's like years before it become, you know, real. And so, oui, pour Jennifer, la carte que vous avez montrée de la de ces endroits où la chaleur augmente énormément avec les sécheresses, et d'après le dernier rapport du GIEC, il va y avoir des endroits, et déjà dans le nord de l'Inde ou dans certains endroits, la vie humaine n'est plus possible. Il fait trop chaud. Et je voulais voir, parce que vous parlez de planétaire, et il y a des idées d'échapper au planétaire chez des néolibéraux ou des millionnaires, des milliardaires, pour aller sur Mars et coloniser Mars, qui est une planète trop chaude. Mais là, on est en train d'imaginer comment on va coloniser, alors qu'ici, on laisse... la chaleur s'accumuler et les gens mourir de chaud. Donc, comment vous ce devenir planétaire d'une planète qui est rendue inhabitable dans certains endroits, et qu'il y a quand même des gens, surtout les milliardaires, qui pensent l'extraplanétaire, toujours sur la logique de la colonisation. On va coloniser Mars et on va rendre Mars habitable. Alors que Mars n'est absolument pas habitable pour la vie humaine, il manque ceci, il manque cela. Donc toutes ces contradictions-là, je n'ai pas de réponse, mais ça m'intéressait.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point, is how people with resources are able to form exit strategies that are on the lines of science fiction. And there's Mars and Elon Musk and a whole set of initiatives there, which it would be interesting to think of that in a kind of colonial logic. What does it mean to assume control of a planet for the purposes, not just of possessing that planet, but of willfully dispossessing planet Earth and leaving people behind? I mean, ordinarily, it's a kind of arriving at undiscovered lands, you know, in the old narrative. But this is a much different kind of way of thinking about coloniality. So that could be quite an interesting project. And I know that the area of post-colonial science fiction is also a very rich and generative area right now, with lots of interesting PhDs, which I wish I had more time to read. But that is, I think, one genre of study where this exploration is taking place. And it's not just Mars that's being looked at as a place of colonizing. For instance, New Zealand has had this problem, for instance, with Peter Thiel.
We're all going to New Zealand.
Yeah. So, you know, he's bought, I don't know, a 4,400-acre sheep farm down there to basically set up his, probably not just bunker, but the, you know, the new shire in his kind of Hobbit-inspired end-of-the-world scenario. So I think this will be a real problem, for instance, because people in India, Bangladesh, for instance, will be underwater. You know, many parts of the Middle East, for instance, are reaching the wet bulb index. The technical term is for that, but they're now having days where people actually will die just from being outside, so let alone working in those temperatures. So I think this is a really important question, and I think there are other ways of writing about this within a kind of fiction-based or fiction meets theory way of speculating toward new ways of understanding these colonialities.
Did you want to say something before?
Yeah. I mean, I can't respond for Jennifer, but I think what I find useful, I think there's many things that aren't useful about Spivak's concept of planetarity, but the fact that it's a different verb, it's not the planetary as an adjective, and it's not the planet. It's naming some kind of relation with this world or earth or globe that we inhabit, and we can choose which term. But it's not a relation in which the world or the globe or the planet is an object to be controlled and to be colonized. So it's precisely pushing against that. So planet Mars is just another planet, right? So that's the point. We want to get outside of thinking that. Yeah. So the planetarity is a kind of relation, and I think that's perhaps what you're trying to say.
Okay. I'm very cognizant of time because I was told that we must go at 5. So we have 2 questions.
Just one comment. The colonization of the space is also the cyberspace. Recently, there was a presentation here in Paris of Olivier Grimaud about a project of some very rich people, which apparently has the veto, I mean, the green light of the Dalai Lama, of putting the brain of the people who are dying into a new type of software, so they become avatar. Because if the thinking is the subject, why would you need a body? Okay, so that's the number one, not really science fiction thing happening. Number two, in Brazil, a few years ago, I don't know if you heard about this project, and I don't know if it happened or it started to happen or not, but there was this idea of making holes in trunks of the trees in the Amazon, because the forest in some parts which are left is too dense for all the signals, for the network. And at the same time, you have all this work that is done about trees communicating. So it's a question of imagination also, right? How can we respond to those things?
I kind of think that's the right depressing moment to end on. But I'm open to another question. Or a closing comment, other than...
Well, on...
Can you sum up the last 3 days?
Amazing. An honor. No, this has been, you know, when Marco and Eileen generously said, why don't we have a seminar on your work? I said, you know, and I mean this honestly, I do not lack arrogance. I am not humble. I'm not. But I also know that what I say is true, that I am part of a system of relations, and I think all of us have been engaged for a long time and are engaged in a problem now, and not one of us are going to solve it, and there's not going to be one solution. So first of all, thank you for everyone who came and really gave your brilliance, and it was everyone. And two, thank you for us not finding a solution. I mean, I think what is the problem? I think we rush towards solution. And I think instead what we've gotten, which I really am quite humbled by, is just brilliant people who have been being brilliant thinking, what is this problem and how, where you are, is it kind of maybe something happening and how is it being captured? There couldn't be a better 2.5 days. So I thank you. I thank Eileen and Marco. I thank Lauren for Reed Hall. I thank our translators and of course, not most of all, but secretly most of all of you who have given your time and thought. Thank you.